Hello, everybody. Welcome to Front and Center, brought to you by Frontier Communications. I'm Dan Lovallo, and we are so honored to have as our guests today from the L.U. Burritt Library at Central Connecticut State University, Martha Cruey, who is Reference Instructional Assessment Librarian, and Sharon Clapp, who is Digital Resources Librarian. And one of the reasons we have them on the program today is, as you know, we've done some interviews with the great folks at the Institute of Technology and Business Development, which is located at Central Connecticut State University's downtown campus in downtown New Britain. And there's a great interaction between the library and ITBD. And so we welcome to our program, to Front and Center, Martha and Sharon. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Martha, let's begin with you. Just give us an overview of what your responsibilities are at the library.
Certainly. I was hired and am very passionate about reference instruction and assessing that instruction in the library. Instruction, most people don't think about as being collaborative with the library, but a lot of people these days are being hit by a lot of information. In fact, there's a fact that typical social media users consume 285 pieces of information a day, and that was in 2013. So that's over 54,000 words and as many as 1,000 clicks. Our students just become overwhelmed when they are told, you have to do a paper. So my job is to calm them down, tell them it's okay, you're going to be able to do this, and then help them go through the steps of understanding how they're going to create a topic for themselves, how they're going to find the information to support their opinions about the topic, and then how to use that information ethically and, you know, not plagiarize and cite their information, but also how to synthesize it into their own opinions.
Now, there's a knack to it, right?
There is a knack to it, but everybody can learn it. You know, it's one of those, the library of today is not what it used to be. we're not a warehouse of books anymore. We really are a collection of people who know where the information is and where the right information is for any given topic. So, and even when we don't know where it is, we know where to look. So we can help the students find that information more efficiently.
That's a great comment, and I want to pick up on that a bit later on. But we live in a digital world. So, Sharon, I want to ask you what your responsibilities are as a digital resources librarian.
Isn't that a great title?
It's a
digital
great
resources library. But that does just go to show how much libraries have changed over the years. We do things now where we digitize materials that we have in our special collections and our archives. And we also help people find, as Martha does so well with information literacy, not only does she help them narrow down their topics and begin the research process and go through the research process, but a lot of that now is online. And so she has to understand there's a lot of moving parts there. Now, I am involved in some of those moving parts on the design end, actually. I do website development work. I do some open source software coding. I do sorts of emerging technologies things. I'm interested very much in open educational resources, because we now have this wealth of information that's been digitized. A lot of people are doing interesting work outside of the academy that we like to tap into. And then there are places like the Digital Public Library of America, which you may or may not know about, but it's a big collaborative that's come about in the past few years. And I'm one of Connecticut's community representatives for that project. And what they're doing is not only are they providing digitized materials in a way that is a giant searchable database, they're also providing facility for the creation of online exhibits. They're providing APIs, which allow different programmers to hook into this vast set of resources from all these libraries all around the nation and all these archives and archaeological sites and so forth. And they're also providing a free e-books program for inner city children. So there's a lot of work that's being done by libraries now that is facilitating access to information online. And part of that includes some design back-end coding work. And that's sort of where I got hooked into the ITBD, you know. They were doing some interesting curriculum development around the topics of emerging technologies. And actually, we had a 3D printer at the library because we had the beginnings of a makerspace, which is a common addition to libraries nowadays, where we allow many people to access additive manufacturing technology, which you probably heard about from Rick a
right.
lot.
Yeah. Sure.
So we're sort of on the cutting edge of a lot of technologies because we have to be, and we want to make them very accessible to everybody.
Now, you mentioned the Digital Public Library of America. So if I plug that into a search engine, it would come up?
Absolutely. And I believe it's DPLA. but it will come up. Yeah, absolutely. Google Digital Public Library of America. And there are a lot of great partners involved in that one. It has corporate sponsorship. It has governmental sponsorship. President Obama actually worked to announce that free ebooks initiative to make sure that even in the most economically challenged areas, we're allowing people free access to ebooks for children, you know.
That's terrific. Yeah. Now, Martha, Sharon touched upon it briefly, but explain how the relationship between the library and ITBD developed.
Absolutely. We actually did start with the information literacy part because they are teaching both high school students and college students how to conduct patent researches so that they could determine whether or not their ideas, their innovative ideas, had already been developed by somebody else. And from there, we kind of nuanced our way in and said, you know, it's not just about searching for patents. It's really searching for ideas that people can take and run with and become innovative. It's not, they're not introducing a whole new product. They're working off of other products. So the idea of libraries and creation have always sort of been in the background, but now we really are a proponent for creation. Now we are asking students and helping students to create knowledge as well as products. So if you go in and you find information about a product, say an airplane wing, and you from, I don't know, the Wright brothers, and you want to work on possibly improving that airplane wing, then you would be able to use the reference services along with ITBD innovation services and education curriculum that they have. So they brought us in, originally to teach the high school students how to search Google for patents. And we kind of said, well, you know, you really need to be looking at all the information that you can find on the internet, because students, everybody, myself included, will go to Google when you have a question. But it's not just about using those databases or using the internet to search, but how to actually conduct those searches that we helped them refine with their students.
Okay, let's pick up on that point for just a moment, because there's the old story about, well, if it's on the internet, it must be true. How do we know if it's true, Sharon?
Well, that's exactly what we try to teach people. Yeah, absolutely. That's it. It's a matter of the evaluation of the pieces of information is really what Martha and her cohort in the reference and instruction area are excellent at. And it's sort of like finding the reputability of a website, for example, relies on many different things. You might know that a .gov type site, a site that's providing data directly from the government, the government's real job is to produce information oftentimes, believe it or not. And so she is helping them to guide them to those types of resources and to find bias in the resources that they are finding just sort of generally in the search engines. Now, one of the things that actually I was talking to Martha a while ago about commercial search engines and the way that web developers like myself and some of the people I work with try to make search engines behave in certain ways. We try to tweak. You know, we have search engine optimization because we want our sites to appear higher in the search engine's results list. So I was telling her about these manipulations to the algorithm or our attempts to respond to the algorithm that something like Google or Bing puts together, right, so that our stuff can appear on top. And that kind of changes the end user's experience of what they're getting when they're doing a search. And they don't really realize that. They don't understand what's under the hood at all. And so Martha's been kind enough to incorporate me into her information literacy courses now, where I do a little section that we call sort of the tinfoil hat section, where we talk about some of the black box mechanisms that affect how we get information presented to us online. And there are things like, there was that big controversy with Facebook, like, are you seeing just conservative opinions or just liberal opinions? And this is super important for our democracy, right?
Right.
So this is there is a concept called filter bubbles, and you may have heard of this. There's a TED Talk about it, and there's a really good book about it by Eli Pariser, if I'm pronouncing his name correctly. Anyway, bottom line is that algorithms govern how we see information in the general internet, right? And if you're not aware of what those algorithms are and sort of their why they exist, you might not be getting information that's actually as balanced as you think it is. A lot of times we think, oh, it comes from a computer. It must be like rational and balanced, but it's not. It's being the algorithms are designed by people, you know?
And people obviously have feelings, right? Obviously have opinions, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And actually, the Facebook algorithm is interesting because Facebook's end goal, right, is to keep you on their site longer. And that's how they make their money, is that then they can show more ads to you. That's fine and well. But what that does is that creates a bias in for their engineers to engineer an algorithm that makes you happier. You generally feel happier when you're not being challenged in your notions of the world. And so a lot of times that strange effect that you see of, am I only seeing liberal news or conservative news, comes out of something like that. It's the algorithm is designed to make you feel good. You don't realize you're thinking that you're just getting everything. You're not getting everything.
Right. Just as an aside, by the way, speaking of Facebook, doesn't Facebook have the reputation of always changing its algorithms?
Absolutely. Actually, they all do. Google changes its algorithms all the time, too. In Google's case, you could, and actually in Facebook's case, too, you could probably assume the kindest of the engineers, which is that they're trying to prevent people in Google's case, for example, or Bing's case, one of the commercial search engines, they're trying to prevent commercial website providers from actually tweaking too much and making their results appear above what's more appropriate. In the case of Facebook, I don't always know their motives. It's a little bit less clear.
Right. You're listening to Front and Center. I'm Dan Lavallo. Our guests are Martha Cruey and Sharon Clapp from the L.U. Burritt Library at Central Connecticut State University. Okay, we talk about students, Martha, interacting with the library as far as ITBD is concerned. How about the business entrepreneurs who take advantage of ITBD? How can they and how do they interact with the library?
Absolutely. Well, everybody is welcome in the L.U. Burritt Library. We are a state-run institution, and therefore we are open to everybody. We have had a number of entrepreneurs come to us at the reference desk and ask us for help in finding histories of local businesses, because we do have quite a history of industry within New Britain itself. In fact, we have a New Britain Museum of Industry that is housed in the same building as ITBD. So we help them to find the histories of these industries so that they can use those histories to build new innovative products. They ask us for help with research on other such things as patents, but also industry standards and I'm trying to think of the market research. We have a terrific new database, Mergent, that we just purchased for the library that provides so much history and so many quotations and market research and market industry information, that those are the kinds of resources that we have that the librarians know how to use, and those we offer to the incoming public who might need to use the library. I know that we have discussed having a librarian at the ITBD. It comes and goes with each semester, but I'm pretty sure that we're going to have somebody there more full-time at some time in the near future.
Now, that's exciting.
Yes.
Sure is. Sharon, you were mentioning 3D printing before. How about expanding upon that?
All right. 3D printing is It's fascinating, actually, and I love talking about this in a way because my husband is actually a traditional tool and die maker, progressive tool and die maker. So I'm familiar with the old school manufacturing, which has happened for hundreds of years, I might add. And he even uses in his daily work the same tools his grandparents use.
Wow.
So that tells you kind of how that technology sort of stays the same. But, well, I mean, there's a lot of advanced manufacturing going on as well, but the concept of that technology is reducing, taking a big chunk of metal, for example, and reducing it down to a small part from that big chunk of metal. Now, that's very inefficient. That creates a lot of waste. That creates a lot of pieces of metal, and you're not using things efficiently. Wouldn't it be great if you could just layer up materials in a way that allows them to be whatever shape you want without having to go through all those processes of reduction? And then when you make a mistake as well, it's a little bit easier to fix if you're adding on than if you've already removed too much. So 3D printing allows you to layer small layers, like at a micron level almost, of plastics are usually what we use. There are new 3D printers which allow you to do some form of metallic printing, but we don't have those, not consumer grade. But layers of plastic, so you can do complex shapes. All you need is a CAD file, right? So this is also facilitated by the digital revolution, right? So you have a blueprint from a computer-aided drafting drawing, right? You put that file in, and then suddenly the machine can try and create something out of that file that looks like what that file is representing. So it's really interesting. So obviously, what does this mean for the world? Well, this means something really big because prototyping new tooling, for example, like you have to make tooling in order to make a part, right?
Right.
That's what my husband does. In order to make the tooling, just to prototype something, that takes a really long time and it's very expensive and it wastes a lot. If you could make a prototype out of plastic by layering it up layer by layer and then just tweaking that CAD drawing whenever you need, you would be able to save a lot of time and do that sort of rapid prototyping work. So that's going to be a revolution at every level.
Well, the cost efficiencies would be amazing when you think about it, right?
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. And I think, you know, you're hearing about foodies, like layering up food and making interesting new concoctions. You hear about people who work with cells and biotech doing a really, really high-end version of this with layers of cells. Could you create an organ out of 3D printing? People are doing a lot with the creation of prosthetics. And in fact, Rick may have told you, you know, in the past, they've done some prototyping of medical-type gear so that you could see how it fit on a person, you know?
Well, now, you mentioned 3D printing, and obviously we have the technology for 3D printing, but how do you learn to use a 3D printer? And is that where ITBD comes in? Is that where the library comes in? Talk about that.
Absolutely, absolutely. So I think the move toward makerspaces in many public libraries that are well-resourced enough and in some of our academic libraries allows more people access to that 3D printing, and we can easily show them how to do some sort of basic things with 3D printing that gives them the concept. There are repositories of 3D models out there, such as, you know, we have two 3D printers at the library called MakerBots, right? And these were very popular consumer-grade 3D printers. And there is an accompanying website called Thingiverse, where you can go and find a little 3D model that you want to make. And you just download it, and we can help you with that. The first time you do it, it's fairly straightforward. And then you run it and you see how it works, and it's just fascinating. From there, in terms of the computer-aided drafting, so what ITBD is doing, just to bring it back to them, is that they created this How to Be an Entrepreneur program for both students of CCSU and, to some degree, a little bit more important, not more importantly, but also importantly, for the TRIO High School students from New Britain to teach them all sorts of emerging technologies, things including how to use a 3D printer, and that gives them the concepts of 3D printing. And along the way, they learn some CAD drawing, so they learn how to take 3D models and modify them, and then to put them into the 3D printer and print something out. So, yeah, we can absolutely do that.
Well,
Einstein said that the imagination is more important than knowledge. And there's even a very one of my favorite movie clips from Good Will Hunting where Matt Damon's character says, you know, I could get the same education as you have from Harvard with $2 in overdue book fines. The imagination is where ITBD is taking the students and giving them some background information about how to do the research and how to use the printers properly. But from there, they really want the students to take their imaginations and just go with it. And that's what employers are actually looking for nowadays. And that's why we want to work with not just the high school students, but the college students and the entrepreneurs, because employers, according to Forbes, got a cite, they want students who will, or workers who will persist in solving problems. And there was a great quote by Einstein that he wasn't so smart. It wasn't that he was so smart. It was just that he stayed with problems longer. And that's what the employers want today. So we're trying to not only teach students how to do the research, but how to stick with that research, because the research process is really hard. And it's one of those, you know, processes where, you know, the light bulb, I learned 5 million ways not to make a light bulb. Right. Well, they have to learn how to stick through a process of failure so that they can get to the part where they're succeeding.
But again, from a business blueprint, it goes back to cost efficiency, and whether you're talking about the 3D printer or whether you're talking about having the ability to problem solve, if you have that ability, you would think that it translates to cost efficiencies for the business.
Absolutely. And Microsoft, I'm sorry, my brain is that Microsoft's owner.
Bill Gates.
He got to where he was because he had access to computers, which nobody else did. He was an outlier. So we're giving these students the opportunity to have access to the 3D printers. We're giving them opportunity to have access to the databases, to the information, and teaching them how to use the information right, the right way. And that's where the library ITBD collaboration really helps the students, because they don't have to waste the time trying to find the 3D printer. They don't have to wait in line to use the 3D printer. They have the access to it twice or three times a week.
Joining us today are Martha Cruey. She is the Reference Instructional Assessment Librarian at the L.U. Burritt Library at Central Connecticut State University, and also Sharon Clapp, Digital Resources Librarian at CCSU. We've been talking about the interaction between the library and the Institute of Technology and Business Development, ITBD, which is part of the CCSU downtown campus in downtown New Britain. And, you know, earlier, Martha, we were talking about the relationship between the library and ITBD, but there's also a lot of interesting things going on with the TRIO program. So could you talk a bit about the TRIO program and how it interacts with the library?
Absolutely. They are the students of, New Britain High School, and they are being brought to CCSU to learn about how college education works and what the possibilities are for their futures, and giving them access to educational opportunities that they might not have, such as Bill Gates might not have had he not had access to a computer and then thereby made Microsoft. So we are absolutely trying to give these inner city students the opportunities that a normal suburban student, a high school student, would have. The library gives them access to databases that they would never have. We have a lot of academic library databases, that such as Mergent, which I had mentioned before. We also have Academic Search Premier, which is more of a basic database that they can have access to and understand more of the language, because it is a more general database that covers all academic subjects. So if they were interested in history or, I don't know, fashion, and they wanted to use the 3D printers to help with their interest in fashion and business, they would have that access that they wouldn't normally have in an inner city high school.
So you bring the students into the library and allow them that access too, or how does that work?
Actually, we visit the downtown campus, and we have a smart classroom down there, and we are able to give them the same instruction that we give our college students in this smart classroom. And they each have a computer, and they are able to conduct the searches that we show them how to conduct, and then they are able to explore on their own the different databases and the different open educational resources.
Sharon, I want to talk a bit about, because you're very instrumental as far as seeking out grant opportunities. Talk a bit about that.
Well, as you know, so museums and libraries and other nonprofits are, of course, challenged in these times, like everybody is. But we in particular have been looking for grants to try and further this program and to make a replicable curriculum that people in anywhere, with any type of library and any type of demographic population can roll out a curriculum that will allow students to learn about and work directly with technologies like 3D printing, to learn about the STEM expertise that's in their own community, to learn basic coding that will allow them to think differently. But what we've done is we've worked with ITBD to form a grant narrative for some IMLS grants, which is the Institute for Museum and Library Services, a federal government agency that provides certain types of grants. And these are grants specific to trying to further STEM education among students who might not otherwise have such well-developed opportunities. So,
but apparently there is money out there. The idea is to be able to get that money, right?
There is. We're in great competition, of course.
That's it.
Yeah. The current administration that is in place in the federal government right now is very interested in STEM, actually, and they've put out these sort of mandates, and they're also interested in improving the equity of access to this type of information and training. So this particular administration actually was one of the first federal agencies, whitehouse.gov, to run on an open source software suite. For many years, the government thought, we can't trust that type of software. And that type of software is very interesting because it's an open development platform. In other words, our students in the ITBD can mount a website on the exact same code, and they can contribute code back that the White House might use someday if they got good enough at coding and they develop something that somebody else might find of value. So anyway, this administration is very interested in providing, where there are funds, providing grant opportunities through IMLS and other agencies, I believe NEH and NEA, but we've gone for IMLS so far because we also have this partnership with the New Britain Industrial Museum that is also, as Martha mentioned, housed in the ITBD. And I think it's an interesting partnership because we talk about that development, right? So Yankees were the original innovators. We actually, right. You know, how many patents did we have in New England back in the day?
That's right.
We were the Silicon Valley of the day. It's a different mindset now. So we have to change how we think about things. But there's still that same inventiveness and that same creative power. And so I think it's really interesting to explore together how we can develop these STEM opportunities and to develop a digital repository, perhaps, of local community STEM expertise and of the lessons and curricula that we're forming and testing in these communities.
Everything is changing, and libraries, Martha, are undergoing a transformation. Talk about that.
Oh, yes. We are not the library of even 10 years ago. We are no longer a warehouse of books. We are a creation station. We are a laboratory for students and entrepreneurs of all ages. We have undergrads who are in their 50s and 60s coming back to school. Our collaboration with ITBD, even when we we're not exactly sure if these high school students are actually going to go through college or come to CCSU. We know that they're going to start to build their own self-direction, and they're going to start to learn to think independently, which is what becoming a lifetime learner is all about. And using the library is about becoming a lifetime learner, because you're always asking questions. My son gave me a sticker a while back because he was in that why stage, and I finally said, okay, look, I'll explain the whys that make sense to me, but I can't always explain everything. So he gave me a sticker that said, question everything. And that's what I start all of my classes off with, especially at ITBD, because these students have to learn how to think for themselves. That's what their employers are going to want, whether they go through college and end up with a job, or they get a certificate from ITBD. No matter what they end up doing, if they're going to be successful, they need to learn how to question everything. And their employers are going to want them to be self-directed, be able to think independently, be able to problem solve, be proactive. They want them to be happy to learn new things and be responsible, which in library land would be, you know, finding the correct information and not just citing or cutting and pasting something from Wikipedia. But, I mean, you know, you understand the process of studying history, Dan. And, you know, when you are studying any subject, you're going to get bias. You're going to get one person's view of that. And so you have to learn how to get multiple views of any particular piece of information before you understand where the facts lie and where the biases lie. So today's library is more about instruction and more about libraries are transformational there. And there's a huge movement going on that about why libraries are transforming. And one of the sayings is, because the best search engine in the library is the librarian. Another one is, because the expert in the library is you. So the students are coming into the library and learning, realizing that they know more than they think they do.
Right. That's interesting. Now, from a digital standpoint, Sharon, talk a bit about the digital transformation these libraries are undergoing.
Oh, gosh, I'm glad you asked that, actually, because I was thinking about this on the way over here. Libraries, actually, were at the cutting edge of computer science back in the day. Back at, say, the 60s or so, we developed something called machine-readable cataloging records, which were sets of numbers and letters that allowed you to put together these records that allowed you to sort of index your collection. Remember the old card catalog? This was the basis of a transformation of the card catalog into the digital era, right? And then big, big giant companies like Amazon, they really all base their work on the standards that were created by librarians. Since that time, of course, we've had a lot of work to do in terms of not just having those integrated library systems which manage our business processes, which are things like circulation and you know, we're undergoing a big migration right now in our integrated library system where we're joining up with all of the other CSUs and all of the community colleges as well as the state library into one giant integrated library system, which is a very interesting process. But in terms of digital, so there's a lot of moving pieces in the library. Since information has fundamentally transformed from being artifact-based, from being print-based, to now having all these electronic representations, there's all these interesting implications. Like, what pieces do we digitize and where do we put them online? How do we make them accessible? How do we preserve them for future generations? There's not a lot of money in digital preservation, so you don't see a lot of corporations going after that one. So that is a place where libraries and archives still stand as important, sort of, in some ways, guardians of cultural history and knowledge. But also this important work that we do of making digital technology accessible and trying to help people feel empowered by it. And that's key. You know, if Martha can teach them to use these different databases, right, then they get this high-quality information and they gain confidence in their own ability to be self-directed in their learning. As we a lot of us like to, who are a little old school, like to go back in the stacks, right? And remember how you just sort of like look at books, right? and you have that serendipity moment, mm-hmm, where you find this thing that you weren't really looking for, but it just leaps out at you and you go, oh, that's sort of the bridge from one concept to another concept. And we get that kind of experience sometimes online. So a lot of my work is trying to improve the user interfaces so that people can have that experience even in the online world. So when they're interacting with the library and in their online world, you know, they come to our library.ccsu.edu site, you know, they can actually go in there and get into those databases and get into our catalog and start to explore.
Let me test my memory here. Was it the Dewey Decimal System?
The Dewey Decimal System is absolutely the one that's used by the majority of public libraries and by some of the some parts of our library. Now, in college, there's actually a slightly more intimidating looking system called Library of Congress Classification. And what's kind of tough about that, actually, we discovered is that our students, because they weren't necessarily brought up with library media specialists, unfortunately, in all the schools, they didn't necessarily learn how to read like a Dewey Decimal Number, which would be a gentle entree into the Library of Congress classification. So sometimes they come to us, and the chief question we might get on the reference desk is like, how do I find this book? Even though they've pulled up the call number, for them it's a little intimidating to go into the stacks, and then we just show them how to read it, and it's very simple from that point. And then they start seeing that the way we've put things together is to try and put subject areas together, and then they start seeing the sort of beauty and logic of the information architecture of the print library, too.
I always like to ask our guests about their career. So, Martha, I'm going to start with you. What interested you to pursue the career that you're now in?
Oh, that's a good one. I have had so many careers since I graduated college. I really always wanted to be around books when I was growing up. And I thought maybe I wanted to be a teacher. And that was around the time of the Columbine event. And I just said, no, that's not really quite my thing. And then I took a personality test or something by a career expert, and they said, oh, one of these great ideas would be for you to be a librarian. And I think it probably was always in my future. I just didn't realize it because I had worked in the library as a college student, and I had spent a lot of time in the library in my younger days. But actually, my father was in on the ground floor of the technological world when I was growing up. And I remember these computers he would bring home, and he would put the telephone on the computer, and he would dial into the computer at work. And it was all analog at the time, of course, but it was in me. This information technology was in me, and the educational aspect was in me. Teaching was in my blood as well. So I learned how to learn Socratically. I learned through experience. And I think that that's the premier way of learning anything in the library, is by experiencing, looking through the stacks and finding something interesting, learning the experience of going on to the computer and finding something in a Google search that you never thought you would find. All of this is really an important way of helping our students, our children, our next generations to find out who they are. And so I think that's probably, I love my job. I love coming, I commute from Norwalk every day, actually.
Wow. You really love your job.
I travel back every day. and I think about, you know, what I'm going to teach the students the next day on my way to and from work every day.
That's terrific. How about you, Sharon?
Well, actually, you know, libraries were a big thing for me, too. I can remember, this was a big part of my growing up, was going to the library every Friday and going to my little town public library. And I used to get stacks of books, like 20 books at a time, however many they would let me take out. I was like crazy. And then I remember when I was 12, I was old enough to be a library page, and my sister had been a library page before me. So I was like, and that's, you know, reshelving books and things like that. So, of course, I wanted to do that. And then I did that. And of course, I won't lie, I got a little lost in some of the stacks sometimes finding stuff, and then I'd end up with a huge stack of books to take out again. But what's interesting, I didn't necessarily intend to become a librarian like many of us. My sister always wanted to be a librarian her whole life. And God bless her, she's a public librarian, public reference librarian now up in Vermont, and she loves it. That was always her thing. I didn't know what my thing would be. When I went for my undergrad, it was archaeology. and I loved anthropology and archaeology. But the realities of becoming becoming a contract archaeologist are pretty harsh. And so when I left school, I had to look for a job. And the first job that I got was, interestingly, in Computers for a Library Automation Network. And it was providing help desk support. But here's the weird part is my whole life, the only way I've gotten a job ever is that I have just been more confident with digital technology than anyone else. It hasn't been a piece of paper. I got hired to the Hartford Currents News Library, actually, when I was 18 or 20. And it was only because I was not intimidated by the mainframe-based system that they had and what they were using to spit out the newspaper articles into a big database. I had no problems with that. And so when I went back to college as a non-traditional age student, I remember that everybody would always turn to me for help. Everybody on the dorm floor that I was on always oh, I have a computer problem. Ask Sharon, you know. And so somehow this got me a job, even though I didn't always have the piece of paper yet. And that's kind of what I want the students to be, that empowered, because I think it was just exposure. My mom actually bought me one of those. Do you remember the little tiny set-top TV set, hook into your TV set?
Oh, absolutely.
Computers,
yes.
Remember those? Like the Commodore 64?
Yep.
I was given one. My mom tried so hard to save the money, and she got it for me one Christmas, TI-449A. And I loved that thing, and I programmed in BASIC all the time. I was making these little programs that were, you know, to make your own adventure stories, and they were so much fun. But then my mom did mention, you know, you're not much of a math person, so I don't see you doing programming in the future. So I kind of put that aside and then went and explored these other things that really interested me. And I think that's also where I don't want them to forget that there's a lot of creativity in activities like coding and building things. I really want them to feel empowered.
What do you do? Because technology is changing by the nanosecond. In fact, we'll ask you, Sharon, and you, Martha, what do you do in order to stay up to date with technology?
Well, lots of research. Let's bring it back around.
No, playing.
Yes, a lot of playing. So actually, I brought with me today, not that anyone can see, but I brought with me an Amazon Echo. Forgive me for using a proprietary thing. And
that's
I also
all right.
brought with me a Raspberry Pi, because I want to show you this Raspberry Pi is like a $35 computer that you can buy. And so it looks like just a little electronic motherboard kind of thing.
It looks like a small Apple TV box.
I've 3D printed an outer casing for it, but inside you'll just see it just looks like the insides of your computer,
that's right.
but on a very small scale.
Right.
So that is a fun thing to play with, and there's no harm in playing with these types of things because there's such inexpensive technologies now that they're open source. They run on the Linux operating system, which is an open source piece of software, so it's free to use, no licensing costs. Mm-hmm. So you can just play with this to your heart's content.
And you plug it into a computer monitor?
Yeah, you plug it into a monitor, a keyboard, and a mouse, and then it's fully functional, and you plug it into the network if you want to pull down some information. There are also add-ons which can allow you to make this wireless. I believe the later versions of this might have Wi-Fi built in. But
can you store information on it?
Absolutely.
You
this
can.
Thing is a computer. It's a full computer.
Wow.
It really is. And it's amazing because we used to have that discussion about can we get a laptop into everybody's hands? We can get a computer into everybody's hands.
And that costs just $35.
Absolutely.
That is
Absolutely.
Phenomenal.
And there's actually an even less expensive sort of version of this as well. But this one is the one that's most easily supported. Like you can find the most recipes online for, they call
wow.
it like Raspberry Pi, find yeah. a recipe and then build something. Yeah. And then things like the Amazon Echo is my latest toy. I just ordered it and it responds to your voice. So I say, Alexa, play, you know, music and or the type of music. Like I said, play Beatles. And she played the Beatles for me. And then I said, turn up the volume. And she turned up the volume for me. And so I found online also, again, I found a recipe for how to create a program that would create a little trivia game. So I made this trivia game, and then I spun up an Amazon server to serve this out. And I ran it. I ran home. I did that at work. And then I ran home, and I'm like, oh, I don't have the Echo with me. I can't try it out. And I tried it out at home, and I'm like, Alexa, play play reindeer games, what the trivia game was called. And she goes, I'm going to ask you five questions. And then she scored me. And unfortunately, because I didn't write the initial program, I didn't know the answer to these questions. I didn't score too well. But I'm now going to rewrite that code. So now I have the code, right?
Right.
All I have to do is replace the pattern of where the questions are with questions that I do know the answers to, and then program for her what the appropriate responses to be accepted are.
Right.
And then I can have my own little trivia game.
Wow. Now, you mentioned Amazon and the Echo, and I was reading the other day what Amazon is attempting to do is integrate entire households as far as how we run our house, from cooking to whatever, by using the Echo. That's the next step Amazon is doing. I see you shaking your head. Yes, both of you.
Absolutely. That's exactly it. She hooks right up to, Internet of Things is the next big thing, right? And this is why we're going to need even more coders. They say like a million jobs are not going to be filled by 2020. That's how much of a gap there is between the need for coders and programmers and what we can currently supply in our current education system, the way it's working. But, you know, so there's this whole Internet of Things is the basis of this, that all our appliances are going to get smart, everything's going to get smart, and then it all hooks up. And so you can say, Alexa, turn up the thermostat or turn down the thermostat or whatever, and you'll be able to send those commands from your phone. Actually, I can send her commands from my phone already.
Wow.
And that's amazing. I personally am a little not so fond of doing complete IoT things, because I know, having worked online for so long and having run servers for so long, I know how hackable things are. And so for me, the first thing I'm going to do is not going to be to hook up my whole home. But that's just me.
Right.
But it's interesting to know what the possibilities are.
The Echo, by the way, is relatively inexpensive, right?
Yeah, this it's $179 for the Echo base station, and then there's some new knockoffs of it. But what's interesting is I found a Raspberry Pi recipe to make your own Echo out of a Raspberry Pi.
Wow!
And I thought that would be a fun project to do with the kids.
Yeah, that's just exciting. We are running out of time. So, Martha, first of all, anything else you'd like to add?
There is one other thing I'd like to add, and that's that one of the pieces to the grant was the concept of bringing the parents of these kids in on the concept that they are as capable of working with technology as their kids are. There are so many people out there who freeze up, especially the older generations, because they think, I don't want to break it. It's too expensive. I'm afraid I'm going to blow up something. And it's really not that hard. And we really want to get the parents of these students as invested in the concept of the technology future as the students are, because we do have so many jobs that are going to be requiring people who can do these jobs. There are still a lot of people who are underemployed in this country, and we really do need to get all the generations invested in this concept of research and learning and being a lifetime learner and stretching yourself and stretching your paradigms. So I think that's one of the things that we really need to work on, is reminding people that it's never too late to learn.
Okay. And Sharon, we've got about 15 seconds. So anything else you'd like to add?
That was fabulous, Martha. I think she took it out. I think that's everything.
Well,
thank you.
Martha, Sharon, thank you both for appearing on Front and Center.
Thank you so much
for having us.
You're
it's
welcome.
Great.
Our guests have been Martha Cruey and Sharon Clapp from the L.U. Burritt Library at Central Connecticut State University.